Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to 231 Anatomy, November 23rd, Monday. And we have two lectures this week, but there's also Thanksgiving this week. So if you have a class on Thursday, don't come, or Friday, don't come, because those are holidays. All right, and we're going to get into lymphatic system today. So I'm going to turn some lights down. No, that one I like that. Oh, the microphone. All right, take a look at the schedule. What did we say? November 23rd? It is November 23rd. Yes, we're going to get into lymphatic system and maybe into respiratory system a little bit later. And here is the mic. Hold your ears. I don't know what the volume's set at. Check, 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 check. Oh, good. Sounds good. All right, you guys, who's ever making noise back there? Step outside so everybody can hear me, okay? I don't know who that is. Actually, I do know exactly who you are. I know where you... Hey, you guys! Somebody smack those guys. Smack those guys. Shush up! Okay, because we want to get started. All right, go outside. Go outside if you're going to talk, all right? Yeah, I'm talking to you guys. All right, so... Don't forget, your last exam, December 9th, that's a Wednesday, and these are the chapters, 19 through 25. And what are we doing today? We're doing chapter 20, so we've got a couple more. These are all short chapters, so just keep persevering, and you'll get through them. All right, I'm going to send out an extra credit assignment. Actually, it's a remediation assignment. It relates to the last test, and it has to do with the autonomic nervous system. So I'll send you the figure that I want you to study and some questions, and also the structures of the ear, the outer ear, middle ear, and inner ear. I did send you that one table. I'm going to resend that to you, and I'll have some questions regarding that starting next week, and maybe we'll do it in lecture. I'm not sure where we're going to do it just yet. All right, and then we'll figure out how many points are on that remediation test. Two parts, autonomic nervous system and structures and functions of the labyrinth, okay? All right, anybody got a question on the schedule? Anything, question on what we've covered previously? All right, I guess that's pretty good. So I'm going to put the schedule away. Say again? Oh, the screen is off. Thanks. All right, hopefully it comes on. Otherwise, I'll just draw on the board and keep the lights off because you all complain about my drawing sometimes. Okay. That's why it's so dark up front. Okay, so lymphatic system. All right, so what's the composition of the lymphatic system? Well, there's a fluid called lymph, and it's going to be contained in vessels called lymph vessels, and there should never be any blood in there. Lymph is a lot like plasma that comes from blood. We'll see why it's derived from blood. Then there are cells called lymphocytes, and you know what? You know what a lymphocyte is already because you had a practicum. It's a white blood cell, and... Back then I said it's an immune response cell, it fights infections. And just for fun, there are two kinds of lymphocytes, there's a B and T. The T lymphocyte is a contact killer, and it actually has to bump into the bacterium, and when it does, it latches onto the bacterium and then explodes it. What's that process that we say explodes? There's an organelle. A vesicle inside the cell, whose job that is. A lysosome, does that ring a bell? Lysosome, so when you lyse something, you destroy it, you blow it up. And that's what the contact killers do. The other kind, a B lymphocyte, produces antibodies. So the B lymphocyte doesn't have to come in contact with the bacteria, it just secretes things into the blood that when they bump into the bacteria, they lyse the bacteria. Right, those are antibodies. All right, so lymph then is contained in lymphatic vessels. And there are structures along lymph vessels. On the lymph travels back to the heart. And on its way, it's got to pass through a little nodule of tissue called a lymph node. And its job is to fight infection as well. Then there are some tonsils. And those are lymphatic organs in our mouth and pharynx and even up by our nasal cavity. They help fight infections from entering via our nose and our mouth. So the tonsils are there. Right, and so you can see there's not just one pair, but there are a number of pairs. The spleen, which I see right here, probably all of you have seen that in lab doing the fetal pig dissection. That's an important immune organ. It can also help fight infection. And the thymus gland. Here's the thymus gland. When we do our dissection, sometimes we can see that in this cavity. What do we call this cavity right here? Yeah, thoracic cavity is right. Think smaller. External cavity. I don't know if I've ever heard that before, but it's that one cavity that you didn't hear the name of until you took this class. Mediastinum. That's right. So the mediastinum is right smack in the middle. There's no heart on this particular illustration, but that would be in the mediastinum as well. All right. Thymus gland. This is where those T lymphocytes go to gain competence. Right? All these lymphocytes are produced in red bone marrow. They get into the blood and travel through the blood, and the T lymphocyte then goes to the thymus gland to mature. And that's why it's called a T lymphocyte, because it matures in the thymus gland. All right, so all of these bright colors right here are lymphatic tissues. And here's one right here, the appendix. You've probably heard of that one. That is the leftover organ from the cecum that we'll see in our fetal pig. It has shrunk down, and now it is just lymphatic tissue that fights infection, right, and prevents bacteria that are in the large intestine from getting into your body. And as well as all these other aggregated lymph nodules throughout the digestive tract also fight infection. Now, the large intestine should have bacteria, right, but those are normal, non-pathologic bacteria, but it's the job of your lymphatic system to control and kill the pathologic varieties, right? Because the non-pathologic actually produce vitamins for us. So they're pretty important. All right, so what's the function of the lymphatic system? Well, I see a number of different things right here. Let's talk about the first one. Maintains fluid balance. So, fluid balance. All right, what's a vessel that brings blood away from the heart? Artery. Okay, and then where does it go? Okay. I just want the name of a blood vessel. So a blood vessel that brings blood away from the heart is an artery. A vessel that brings blood back to the heart is a vein. And what's the type of vessel that's in between? Capillary for exchange, right? So things can actually leave the blood in a capillary. So that's what I see right here. I see the heart, and I see an artery that's red. All right, so from that, you can tell me what circulation is this illustration from, systemic or pulmonary? Yeah, systemic, right? Systemic arteries are high in oxygen. All right, so here is blood going to a capillary, and you just told me that its function is for exchange. So a lot of things leak out, fluid, some small molecules, gases. And as a matter of fact, let's see, about 30 liters leak out of the capillaries at this proximal end every day. So what's 30 liters like? What is this thing? This is 1 pint. This is 500 ml. So this is half a liter. So you can imagine how much fluid leaks out of your body every day. If this is only half a liter and 30 leave your cardiovascular system every day, so you would dehydrate if it would leave the blood, right, and never return. So at the distal end of the capillary, that fluid is resorbed. And in the meantime, these cells have taken up all those important nutrients that they need. But it doesn't pick up, this distal end doesn't pick up all the fluid that leaked out from the proximal end. Right? 27 gets reabsorbed at the distal end. That leaves 3 liters left in tissue spaces. Right? So every day, 3 liters, that is 6 of these things. And you would swell up, that process we call edema. And that would not be good. So there is another kind of vascular system that can capture all of that fluid and return it back to the blood, and that is the lymphatic system. All right, so here I see a bunch of lymphatic vessels, and their job is to pick up excess tissue fluid. Right? It's not a complete circulatory system like the cardiovascular system. Right? It starts in tissue spaces. So here is a lymph capillary. It's just a dead end. And then tissue fluid enters this capillary, and then it makes its way back to the heart. Does anybody remember what a vein has, a special structure that an artery does not have? Valves, that's right. So here is another kind of vessel that has valves. Because lymphatic vessels are a lot like veins, they're very low pressure, they have valves as well in them. So now you know three kinds of structures that have valves. What are three things? What are three structures that have valves that you're aware of? The heart. Okay, how many valves does a heart have, just for fun? Nice, four valves. What else? Veins and lymphatic vessels, right. Okay, and those valves just prevent the backward flow or retrograde flow of blood. And here I can see a valve. Okay, so here are some valves. Here is that lymph node that I was talking about, and we're going to talk about those in just a second. All right, so that's part of the job of the lymphatic system, to recoup fluid that is lost in tissue spaces and return it back to the cardiovascular system so you do not swell up. That's an important function. All right, so how does that tissue fluid enter a lymph capillary? Well, here is the dead end of one of those capillaries. We really zoomed in, and it has these flap-like mini valves, right? And when you move around, it opens this valve and closes these valves, and tissue fluid just enters the capillary, and just like in a vein, it can only go toward the heart, right? Because there are other valves, like for instance, right here. Right? So that looks like a valve in a vein. So lymph can only actually go back to the heart as a result of that. All right, and prevents edema. Another thing that lymphatic system does is it's important for fat absorption from your small intestine. I don't have a picture right now, but when we get into digestive system, we're going to see that there are capillaries, blood capillaries for absorbing sugars and amino acids and other kinds of compounds, but fats are not absorbed by capillaries of the cardiovascular system. They're absorbed by capillaries of the lymphatic system, and they have a special name. They're called a lacteal. I'll show you where that lacteal is when we get to digestive system. All right. Another function, last function, is the defense system, immune system. So lymph nodes, like these things right here, I can see lymph vessels enter and I can see one lymph vessel leaving. So lymph is filtered by these things and pathologic organisms are filtered out. And then when they're filtered out, the lymph node instructs those B lymphocytes how to attack those particular bacteria so it can recognize them and kill them. Okay, and the spleen also contains lymphocytes. Do you remember where the spleen is? Who could kind of tell me where the spleen is located? Some of you have done a dissection already. Where's that spleen located? What cavity? Abdominal cavity. Good. Left side or right side? Left side. What organ is it really close to? The stomach. Yeah, it kind of hangs around the greater curvature of the stomach. All right, so that's the spleen. It's really thin, but it's got a smooth surface. All right, it contains lymphocytes. There are other kinds of tissues found everywhere in the body. Let's go back to, where was that at? It was here. All right, so here are the major areas of lymphatic tissue in this nice bright yellow color, but there's lymphatic tissue pretty much everywhere in the respiratory tract and digestive tract that's not colored because it's microscopic, it's too small. And it's called mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue, or MALT. We're just going to call it MALT. Right? And there are lymphocytes there. And those lymphocytes can identify bacteria and maybe some viruses and fight infection. And MALT is just it's ubiquitous in the body to fight infection. Okay, so it is in digestive tract, respiratory, urinary, reproductive tract, and they contain germinal centers just like a lymph node. All right, so what is a germinal center? What does it mean to germinate? Anybody have an idea? What does it mean to germinate? Okay, proliferate. I like that. That's another term, but I'm not sure everybody knows what proliferation means. Probably we use that term a lot in botany. That's a hint. Germination is when you take a seed that's dormant and you put it in soil and you water it, what does it start to do? It starts to grow. So germination is growth, right? You have start with maybe one cell or a couple cells, and then you end up with hundreds and thousands, hundreds of thousands, right? That's what germination means. So a germinal center is a place in our body that undergoes that same kind of process, right? But the cells that grow are fighting infection, right? So they're not growing leaves or anything like that, but they're growing to fight infection. That's a germinal center. And when a tissue grows, right, we sometimes use that other term. When you have one cell and it grows into two, then four, then eight, right, 16, we call that proliferation. So when a tissue is proliferating, it gets bigger, right? And when it stops, it stays the same size. So proliferation is when a tissue starts to grow. So different ways of thinking about germination. So a germinal center is a place that can start growing, but more importantly, it can start protecting your body. It can start the immune response. All right, lymphatic vessels. They begin with lymph capillaries. They're just a simple squamous epithelium, like a capillary or the lining of any other kind of blood vessel. And they have those vein-like little mini valves at the tip of a lymph capillary that can absorb tissue fluid. And just like a vein, that fluid moves back to the heart mostly because of two kinds of pumps. And that is the skeletal muscle pump, and who knows a second one? Skeletal muscle pump. Skeletal muscle, when you compress a vein, right, it's going to push blood away from that area. It's going to push it down to the periphery or to the heart. Which way is it going to go? Only to the heart. Because why? There are valves, so it can't go back down to the periphery. Same thing for lymphatic vessels. All right, so contraction of smooth muscle is important for moving lymph around, and also just breathing. Anytime you turn your thoracic cavity into a vacuum cleaner, not only do we suck air into our thorax, but it sucks fluid from the rest parts of our body, right? And that's called the respiratory pump. All right, so that's how lymph moves around in our body. All right, so here is the complete duct system, right? It's all over the place. And these little nodules right here are what we call lymph nodes. And there are certain locations superficially on your body where there is a group of them, right? Some in the inguinal region, some in the axillary region, some in the cervical region. And these lymph nodes are germinal centers, right? And when they get stimulated, what do these germinal centers do? They start to grow. And since they're superficial, you can palpate them. You can actually feel these nodes. And so when would you be able to feel a node in your neck or your axilla? When you have an infection. So that's a nice simple way of trying to determine where an infection is in your body. Is it just localized in one area? Is it on both sides of your body? Right? Is it only in your head and neck, or is it all over the place? Right? So that's why a physician or some kind of healthcare provider might want to palpate lymph nodes in your body to see if they have become activated, if they're starting to germinate to fight an infection someplace. Right, as lymph travels back to the heart, I don't see the heart, but the heart would be right about here, it has to pass through at least one lymph node to be filtered. Right, and when we look at this diagram right here, I see a lot of asymmetry. I see the whole left of the body and the lower extremity on the right side all drain in to the thoracic duct. Right, and then the thoracic duct makes its way to the left subclavian vein, and lymph returns to the cardiovascular system right here. And then the right side of the head and the right side of the thorax and the right upper limb all drain into a different area. It doesn't drain into this thoracic duct. Okay? It drains into a lymphatic duct. And then that enters into the right subclavian vein. So that's kind of funny how the lymphatic system has been set up. So the thoracic duct is a lymphatic vessel, but there are no lymph nodes on it. It's just like an inferior vena cava. Right? And then here is a little area right here called the cisterna chyli, and it's just a collecting basin from lymph from all the lower parts of your body. All right, so the subclavian veins are where lymph fluid returns to the cardiovascular system. Right lymphatic duct, okay, right lymphatic duct empties into the subclavian. All right, so what do all of these different organs, lymphatic organs, have in common? Well, they have lymphocytes, like B lymphocytes. They also have other kinds of white blood cells that can surround a bacteria, gobble it up. That's called a macrophage. And there's other kinds of cells in these centers as well. And I said lymphocytes originate from red bone marrow, and then they go, and since they're in the blood, they travel to lymph organs where they can just stay in a germinal center and wait for an infection to take place. Microorganisms, or things that don't belong in your body, can stimulate lymphocyte cell division in what we call germinal centers. So what's another way of thinking of lymphocyte cell division? That is, mitosis, and what somebody mentioned before, that's proliferation. So those lymph cells are going to proliferate so that they can produce a much better immune response. So when a germinal center is activated by a foreign microorganism, we call that immune system activation, right? So if there is a germinal center and a bacteria gets into that center and those germinal cells recognize it and they start to proliferate, that's what we call immune system activation. And those lymph nodes then are going to grow. And maybe somebody's had some lymph nodes that were swollen and they can be painful sometimes when you palpate them. All right, so all of these organs that we're going to look at pretty much are the same, right? The tonsils. Lymphatic organs that protect against pathogens from entering via the nose and the mouth, and it contains that diffuse lymphatic tissue that we call malt. And this slide right here showed it pretty well. Okay, you have some sublingual tonsils, you got some palatine tonsils, and a pharyngeal tonsil. Now these tonsils are kind of interesting because their job is to fight infection. But ironically, sometimes these lymphatic tissues get infected themselves. And so when you have an infected tonsil, I'm sure you know what that's called. What is that called? Tonsillitis, right? Okay. And every once in a while, somebody gets a tonsil that's infected and the infection never goes away. It's just a chronic tonsillitis. And these tonsils right here, and somebody with a chronically inflamed or infected tonsil will have a sore throat like every other day, and it might be a really bad sore throat to where you can't go into work. So that is, you know, it really puts a crimp in your lifestyle when you have a sore throat like that all the time. So you actually might elect to remove that tonsil that's chronically infected, right? And that's called a tonsillectomy. And that is really nice. The good thing about that is that when people get a tonsillectomy, they might not have a sore throat for a year. So they'll be really healthy. That's amazing. Could you imagine having a sore throat every other week going to not having one for a year? That's amazing, right? You'd be really happy. But in the adult, that's kind of a major surgery because a tonsil is almost as big as the tip of your thumb. And when you remove that from your throat, then that puts a big scar, an open wound in your throat, and that really hurts for a long time in the adult. You'll probably be off work for about 2 weeks. Right? If you get a gallbladder removed, you might be off work for 1 day. Tonsillectomy, much longer period of time. Kids have a much better time at a tonsillectomy. They probably will be up running around eating ice cream the very next day. Right? They just seem to recuperate. Maybe the tonsils aren't as big in little kids compared to adults. All right, so those are the tonsils. They can be infected. Here is the appendix. And the appendix is right on the bottom of the cecum, which is the first part of the large intestine. So here's large intestine, the ascending, the transverse, and the descending. This part right here receives digested material from the small intestine. Small intestine empties into the cecum. You notice that the fetal pigs have a very large cecum, right? It sticks way out. Because of their diet, they need that for digestive purposes. But since our diet is a lot different, that cecum has shrunk down, and what's left is the malt tissue that was in that cecum to begin with. And just like the tonsils, guess what can happen to the appendix? It can be infected as well, and that's called an appendicitis, and then it should be removed, because if that infection gets worse and worse and worse, then the appendix can actually burst, right? And then you get all of that nasty material anywhere in your pelvic cavity, abdominal cavity, filled with bacteria, dead white blood cells, right? It's a real mess. And if it does burst, you'll probably feel like dying, but chances are you're not going to die, right? It's kind of serious, but it's not all that serious. But nonetheless, it's better if you have an appendicitis to have it removed before it bursts, right? That's called an appendectomy. Anybody in here ever have a burst appendix? Anybody burst? No? Anybody have an appendix removed in here? No. Yeah, we're just really healthy. Okay. I still have mine too. All right, so that's there. That's the appendix. Okay. Lymph nodes. Right, lymph nodes are these things, right, that lymph has to travel through to get back to the subclavian vein, right, via the right lymphatic duct or the thoracic duct over here. And their job is to filter lymph. Let's take a look and see what one looks like. There's one right here. All right, so there's a capsule around the outside, fibrous capsule, and then I see some structure on the inside. So this circular structure right here is what we call a follicle. And inside we have those lymphocytes and macrophages. And this is the thing that can become activated, so we call this a germinal center. Right? And here's another germinal center inside a follicle all the way around. These connective tissue little septa that separate the germinal centers, these are called trabeculae. And so blood filters into these things, lymph, right, filters into these things and then into these sinusoids before it drains into another lymph vessel. So these lymph vessels that bring lymph to a node are called the afferent lymphatic vessels. The vessels that take lymph away from a node are called the efferent lymphatic vessels, right? So you're familiar with those terms, afferent and efferent, okay? I would say usually there's probably only one efferent lymphatic vessel. I see two on this particular diagram. All right, but these are the germinal centers. So if a bacteria comes in through this lymph, right, to this area, this germinal center right here will be able to recognize it and develop an immune response and kill that bacteria. And it will do that by growing, right, when it becomes activated, right, through proliferation. Okay, so that's a node. Now what I see here also is that lymph only flows in one direction through this lymph node, right? From the afferent through the node to an efferent and then back up to the heart. Why does lymph only flow in one direction? Because you see valves. Yeah, I see valves all over the place, right? Okay, and all these afferent and efferent. Okay, spleen. We've all seen the spleen in our fetal pig. Spleen is kind of tucked right underneath the stomach right here. And it has a couple functions. It's a reservoir for red blood cells. So if you hemorrhage for whatever reason, you cut yourself really bad, then the spleen can donate some of those red blood cells to bring your red blood cell count back up, right? You don't have to wait around to rebuild all of those red blood cells. But it also filters lymph. So it kind of acts like a lymph node as well. And this organ is held together with connective tissue. And it's not a strong connective tissue, and it's not the stretchy kind, it's the weak kind of fiber. What's the weakest kind of fiber that you're aware of? Reticular, that's right. So the matrix of the spleen is reticular fibers. So the spleen is kind of fragile. It can rip apart, unfortunately. And when it rips, it produces a pretty large hemorrhage because it's loaded with blood vessels. All right, so if somebody has a torn, ripped spleen, because it's bleeding so much, then you need a surgical intervention, right, to help the spleen out so the person doesn't bleed to death. Well, usually, like for skin, if you have a cut on your skin and you want to bring the edges of that wound back together, approximate the edges so that they can grow back together again, you can put a suture in, right? Either a metal suture or a thread or something to close the wound over. If you try to use that same technique for the spleen, as soon as you try to sew a suture in, it's going to rip some more, right? And then it rips some more, and so what do you want to do? Well, you want to put another suture in to prevent that rip from bleeding. And you put another suture in, and then it rips some more. So suturing a spleen is not possible to stop that hemorrhage. The only thing that works is to tie off the blood vessel that is supplying blood to that part of the spleen, right? You put a ligature around that blood vessel, prevent blood from getting to the spleen, and then you can remove that part of the spleen that is hemorrhaging. That's the only way to do it. All right, spleen is a pretty big organ. Let me see, I got a picture of it here someplace. All right, spleen is a pretty large organ, right? So here's the splenic artery, splenic vein, and okay, so it kind of looks like a lymph node, right? We see these septations, and I see different kinds of pulp. I see red pulp, and I see white pulp. The red pulp is where red blood cells are stored, and that's the place where blood is filtered for microorganisms. And this white pulp over here is where lymph tissue is filtered, or lymph fluid. Lymph fluid is filtered for pathologic organisms. And it's loaded with germinal center so that when an infection enters your body, it can produce a lot of lymphocytes to fight that infection. All right, so it's loaded with lymphatic vessels. All right, and as we said, it's easily traumatized. A lot of people, when they get into like an automobile accident, motorcycle accident, even football players sometimes, have to get their spleen removed. Right, and what's one of the jobs of the spleen? What does it fight? That fights infection. That's right. So sometimes students ask me, well, what happens when you have a splenectomy? Are you more susceptible to infection? Or sometimes a student will ask me, you know, I've had an appendectomy. I don't have my appendix. And since the appendix fights infection, am I going to be susceptible to infection compared to somebody that still has their appendix? And then some other students might ask, you know, I've had a tonsillectomy. Am I going to be more susceptible to infection because I don't have those tonsils, and those tonsils were there to fight infection? And happily, I can say no, because you have so much lymphatic tissue everywhere in your body, that lymphatic tissue that's called MALT, those areas can make up for the tissue that had to be removed. Right? There's only one case, and it has to do with the spleen. If somebody has a splenectomy, they are susceptible to infection compared to a normal population in the following sense. And that is, one of the side effects of surgery, one of the consequences of any kind of surgery is infection. So when people have surgery with a splenectomy, they're at a higher risk of getting an infection. And if that person, during that surgery, is getting a prosthesis like a hip or a knee or some other kind of maybe screws to help put a bone back together, they're even at a higher risk of infection. Right? So if any time somebody puts a prosthesis in without a spleen, then physicians talk about that, and they talk about it with you, and you agree to have the surgery anyway, but you pay really close to make sure there is no post-surgical infection after that. Okay? But everyday life, it really doesn't matter one way or the other. All right, thymus gland, we know where it is, mediastinum, that's where T lymphocytes go. To gain competence. And what kind of killer is a T lymphocyte? It's a contact killer. It's got to bump into the bacteria to lyse it. A B lymphocyte doesn't have to. They can hang out in germinal centers. Where's my cursor? They can hang out in germinal centers and produce antibodies that go into the blood, and then those chemical compounds that we call antibodies, right, can lyse bacteria. So the B lymphocyte doesn't actually have to touch the bacteria to kill it. All right, let me see if there's anything else that I want to say about lymphatic system. You know what? I think that's pretty much about it. All right, so I just want to review functions. It maintains fluid balance. Let me get that diagram back up. Maintains fluid balance because, right, at the proximal end of a capillary, about 30 liters of fluid all over your body leak out. On the distal end, 27 gets resorbed, but that means 3 liters every day is left in your body, and you swell up by that amount. Right? And so that excess fluid, tissue fluid, gets absorbed by these lymphatic capillaries, and then it drains back to the heart, gets back to the cardiovascular system via these subclavian veins. All right, so that's kind of a special circulation system. And it absorbs fat. So your capillaries don't absorb fat in your small intestine. Lacteals do. And a lacteal is just a special kind of lymph capillary. And then what we were talking about last part was the body self-defense system. Because there are germinal centers and lymph nodes and spleen, but there's MALT also everywhere in your body, which can be germinal centers as well. Okay, so what happens? What's the process that happens when a bacteria or something that doesn't belong in your body, maybe it could be a fungus, maybe it could be a virus, gets into a germinal center? What happens to that germinal center? What happens? Like a lymph node. Bacteria gets filtered by a lymph node. What happens? The immune system is activated, so immune system activation, and then those cells start to proliferate and grow, right? So we call that immune system activation, when that proliferation takes place. All right, so that's lymphatic system. Pretty fast. Anybody have any kinds of questions? Anybody read the chapter ahead of time? Pre-lecture reading assignments or anything? No questions? Cyst. I think a cyst can be derived from a number of different kinds of sources. Yeah. So a cyst is just kind of a localized area of inflammation, right? And there's some proliferation, some swelling going on there. So not necessarily lymphatic tissue, not necessarily a lymph node. Okay. All right, so I'm going to put lymphatic system away. Maybe I'll just put it here. In here. 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 Where are all my other ones? All right, we don't need any of those pictures, this picture, this picture. All right, respiratory system. I hope you have your notes for respiratory system. I think we're done with this one, so I'm going to put that away and go over here. All right, so let's talk. So where's the respiratory system? This is a good picture to start with. So here's your respiratory system. Air enters either your mouth or your nose, ends up in the lungs via the trachea and some other passageways. And there are capillaries, pulmonary capillaries in the lungs. So what can happen in the lungs? Exchange, right? So oxygen can enter blood, CO2 can leave, and then it goes back to the heart. So here is the respiratory system. What are the functions? Well, first is ventilation. There are muscles that move bones that change the shape. Actually, what's better to say, changes the size of the thorax, right? We call that ventilation, changing the size of the thorax for inhalation or exhalation. And then because there's capillaries, right, there's gas exchange between air in the lungs and the blood. That's an important part of respiratory system. Another important part is then it transports that oxygen to tissues that need it. There's a special system that transports oxygen, and it also transports CO2. That's not so special. CO2 dissolves in blood pretty well all by itself, but oxygen does not. It needs to bind to a special kind of chemical compound that's in red blood cells. Anybody know what that chemical compound is that absorbs oxygen? Hemoglobin, that's right. Red blood cells are just completely filled with hemoglobin, so much so that it doesn't even have room for organelles. That's why a red blood cell doesn't have a nucleus or mitochondria or anything like that. So transport of oxygen and CO2, and then again, gas exchange in the systemic circulation, right, between blood and tissues for them to absorb oxygen and get rid of CO2. So these are the primary functions of the respiratory system. Okay, the anatomy. Well, okay, I see some lungs. I see this tube over here. This is the trachea that's in your neck. And let's look at the upper respiratory system first. Upper respiratory system. Here is an important exam figure. Oh, I'll get to that in a second. I think I like this one even better. Okay, so here is the back of your throat, right? And the back of your oral cavity, here's your throat. We don't call it throat, we call it the pharynx, right? And then here is the oral cavity. Above it is the nasal cavity. And so the pharynx actually has three main divisions, right? The one just posterior to the oral cavity is called the oropharynx, right? And the one that's just posterior to the nasal cavity, that's the nasopharynx. And this structure, which is part of the airway, right behind it is another part of the pharynx, and it's called the laryngopharynx because this is the larynx, right? So the pharynx is your throat, but there's three important divisions to it. So when we inhale our lungs, air can go through the nasal cavity, through the pharynx, and then into the larynx, then through the trachea into the lungs, or you can breathe through your mouth as well, right? So you can go through the oral cavity, pharynx, and then the larynx, trachea, into your lungs. So the upper respiratory tract is the nasal cavity, these divisions of the pharynx, right? Until you get to all of these structures right here that contain cartilage, and then that becomes part of the lower respiratory tract, right? Lower respiratory tract starts with the larynx. Maybe you've looked at the larynx in lab already. Well, I've got some good pictures I'll show you in a second. Then here is the trachea, and I can see a bunch of cartilage in the trachea. There are rings that hold the trachea open all the time. So this trachea is a tube, but it never collapses. That's pretty important, right? When it gets down over here, then it bifurcates into the left lung and the right lung. And when we look at these lungs, I see the right one has three lobes and the left one only has two lobes. So the left lung is smaller. Why does it look like it's smaller? As a matter of fact, it doesn't look like it's smaller. It really is smaller. Why is it smaller than the right one? Yeah, because here is the heart. So this little notch right here sometimes is called the cardiac notch, right? So the left lung only has two lobes to it. All right, and also, since the heart is right here, this bronchus, right? So a bronchus, this one is a main bronchus from the trachea right after the bifurcation. This is what we call a main bronchus or primary bronchus. The primary bronchus on the left side is smaller because the left lung is smaller. And since the heart is here, it makes more of a 90-degree bend coming off of the trachea. Can you kind of see, maybe you can see that this is more of a 90-degree bend. But the primary bronchus or main bronchus on the right side continues more straight down, and it's larger. And that's kind of important because a lot of times, well, I tell you what, anytime you get some kind of particle, it could be a cracker or anything like that, and put it right in the larynx and let go, guess what's going to happen? It's going to go right into the trachea. It's just going to fall in, right? Because the trachea is held open all the time by those tracheal cartilages. And a lot of times it gets down, this is this area of the bifurcation. That's what we call the carina of the trachea. When it gets down to the carina, right, usually it ends up, guess what lung it usually ends up in? The right one, because this primary bronchus on the right side is bigger and it's more straight to get in there compared to this smaller and more bent main bronchus going to the left lung. Okay, so here is the larynx. All right, so it sounds kind of dangerous to keep this trachea open all the time, but that's really important because in order for us to exhale, we have to pressurize our chest. We have to compress our chest, and when we compress our chest, we're going to compress the trachea, and if it didn't have cartilage and we start to press on the trachea, guess what would happen to it? It would shrink down. It would no longer be a tube, right? When you pressurize it, it would shrink down, and when it becomes occluded, you wouldn't be able to exhale. Air would be trapped in your lungs. Even though it's pressurized, the trachea would collapse and air can't get out. So the trachea is held open all the time so that when you compress the lungs, air can leave really nice and easily. Okay? So that's the reason for that. There is a tube right behind the trachea we call the esophagus. Can't really see it on this slide, but it goes to the stomach. That is not held open all the time. That is closed compared to the trachea. And that has some other important clinical significance because it's closed all the time, right? When the trachea is open all the time. All right, let's take a look at the larynx in a little bit more detail. Okay, so here's an exam figure. I think maybe this was even a quiz figure for you guys, right? All right, so I see a nice oral cavity. I see the opening of the eustachian tube in the nasopharynx, right? So here's nasopharynx, there's oropharynx and laryngopharynx because here's the larynx. I can see some tonsils, right? The lingual tonsil, palatine tonsil, pharyngeal tonsil is up over here. The oral cavity has a couple divisions to it. We call it a palate. It has a hard palate that's made up of the maxilla and part of the palatine bone. And then there's the soft palate over here, which contains some muscle and soft tissues. And it's important that they're soft tissues because they have to move around, right? When you swallow something, this aperture right here has to close. So the soft palate comes to the back of the oropharynx and it blocks off the passageway to your nose so that food goes down into the esophagus right here. So here's the soft palate, hard palate. Okay. And then here we see these wings inside the nasal cavity. We call these nasal conchae. And these condition the air as we breathe it in. So if air is cold, it warms it up. Right? If air is really hot, it cools it down so that we don't burn our lungs. If it's really dry, these nasal conchae humidify the air so our lungs don't turn into potato chips. So, and there's also mucus on these nasal conchae. They can absorb, they can attract dust particles and bacteria and help fight infection. Okay. All right, so here is that larynx. And all of these blue structures are cartilages. This one right here is a trapdoor. When you swallow something, this thing, which we call the epiglottis, flops down over this opening into the larynx. The opening into the larynx is what we call the glottis. And hence, something above the glottis is called the epiglottis. And it's made out of elastic tissue so that when you bend it down, guess what happens when you release those muscles? It goes back up to where it should be, right? So normally, the glottis is open. Until you swallow something, then the epiglottis goes down. Okay. And if food particle does get into the trachea, what do we call that condition when some food or some other kind of material gets into the trachea? Yeah, it's choking. That's right. Somebody said choking. Thank you for saying that, right? And there are vocal cords right here. And in order for those vocal cords to make any sound, air has to flow over the vocal cords. And when you're choking, that prevents air from moving one way or the other across the larynx. So you can't make a sound. So there is a special little sign, some sign language, right? If you can't breathe, and I don't know if any of you have ever been in a position where you can't breathe, you'll know it. It's terrible. It feels terrible. So you want to signal somebody for help, somebody that is CPR trained. And what is the symbol for choking? Okay, the symbol for choking, nice. Two hands, right, on either side of the neck like this, and if anybody's trained, they'll know that you're choking even though you can't tell them, right? And then they can do CPR on you, the Valsalva maneuver, and hopefully open up this airway, and then you'll be friends for life because it's really nice to be able to breathe, okay? All right, well, there is a day of the week when this epiglottis gets a little lazy. It doesn't flop down over the glottis, and a lot of people choke, or most people choke, on this particular day of the week. That seems kind of funny. Why is it just one day? And you know what? On that particular day, there's a time as well. So there's a time, there's a day and a time where most people choke because this epiglottis gets a little lazy. So who can give me a day and a time? A day and a time where there's a high susceptibility of choking. The second most would be Saturday. Okay, and it is right around 5 o'clock in the evening. So what's happening Friday is 5 o'clock in the evening. Happy hour. Somebody said happy hour. That's right. So choking is usually associated with adult beverage, right? You go to a place has some adult beverage and you're with your coworkers and you're telling good jokes and you're eating something, maybe popcorn shrimp or some nachos or something, and you're chewing, enjoying yourself, and you have another beer and you're really enjoying yourself, right? And you're just about ready to swallow that nacho and somebody tells a really good joke about your anatomy instructor, right? And then what do? You go and start to laugh, but there you had that nacho right there, and so that nacho goes into the trachea and you start to choke, okay? So, as a matter of fact, before happy hour, when you sit down, you might actually want to ask if anybody is CPR certified, right, during happy hour, because They might be useful. Has anybody ever saved somebody's life in here by doing a Valsalva maneuver? One person? Oh, no? Okay. But you... Oh, CPR. You've done CPR, so like the chest compressions? Yeah, that kind of stuff. Oh, yeah, that would save somebody's life, too. Okay, there's usually one or two students that have helped somebody at a restaurant or even at home that is choking with that Valsalva maneuver. How many people are CPR certified in here? Quite a few. Nice, 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 nice. Okay. Okay, so that's his epiglottis. Let me move on to, oh, look at that, exam figures. Okay. Here we zoomed in to the larynx. This is an anterior view. I can see a bunch of tracheal cartilages. These things are not complete rings. They're horseshoe shaped, but since we're looking on the anterior side, they kind of look like rings. The opening is in the back. This one right here is almost the biggest one. This is what we call the thyroid cartilage, because the thyroid gland is just below the larynx, so somebody named this particular cartilage the thyroid cartilage. And that's the one that you can actually feel very nicely. That's the point that's sticking out in your throat right there. It doesn't go quite all the way around, right, but almost. The one down below it is called the cricoid cartilage. And the cricoid cartilage is actually bigger than the thyroid cartilage because it does go all the way around. And when we look at a lateral or posterior view, we're going to see that the posterior part of the cricoid cartilage is actually very large. All right, so we got thyroid, cricoid, nice hyoid bone, and guess what's peeking up behind the hyoid bone? All right, so the thyroid cartilage, cricoid cartilage, and all these tracheal cartilages here are hyaline cartilage. This cartilage right here is elastic, and this thing is the epiglottis. That's the trapdoor that flaps down over the glottis, right, when you swallow something, theoretically. All right, here is a lateral view, but kind of more like a sagittal view. We've cut it open. So here is the thyroid cartilage, the point sticking out. Below it is the cricoid. And as we go posterior, look and see how big this cricoid cartilage gets. Right? And again, all these cartilages are there to keep this airway open so that you can exhale. Not so important when you're inhaling, but when you're exhaling. Nice epiglottis right here. A couple other kinds of cartilages in the larynx that we don't go over very much. But this one that very irregularly shaped, that's the arytenoid cartilage. And the arytenoid is important for vocalization. Vocal cords are attached to the arytenoid and some muscles. So when the muscles contract, it moves the arytenoid cartilage around and it can increase or decrease the tension of a vocal cord. And that changes the pitch of that particular voice, that particular sound. All right, so those are the cartilages that you have to know. Arytenoid, cricoid, thyroid, and what's the last one you have to know? Some people might say it's the most important one. It is the epiglottis, right? It's the epiglottis, okay, which is right here. Okay, trachea, windpipe. All right, let's go down to, let's get into the lungs now a little bit. All right, so we were looking at this. So here's the trachea. Here's that bifurcation, the carina. Here's the left main bronchus. Here's the right main bronchus. And then a main bronchus is going to bifurcate once again into a secondary bronchus. And then a secondary is going to bifurcate again into a tertiary. And it's going to get smaller and smaller and smaller until it gets to the spaces inside the lung where gas exchange takes place. All right, so let's zoom over through here. All right, so now we're... I can see an illustration right here, but you can't really see these things with your naked eye. You would need a microscope. But for illustration purposes, okay, we've made it really big for you to see. So the larynx has cartilage, the trachea has cartilage, all of these bronchi, whether they're primary, secondary, tertiary, have cartilage, they're held open. And then the next smallest structure is what we call a bronchiole. So here is a bronchiole. And what's interesting about a bronchiole is that it does not have cartilage. It only has smooth muscle around it. And I can see some smooth muscle right here. All right, so that's the big difference. And then these bronchioles can get smaller. So here is a terminal bronchiole, and it can split into some smaller ones. These are what we call respiratory bronchioles because they have these air sacs on them. And each of these little air sacs is what we call an alveolus. And if we look at a whole bunch of them, plural is alveoli. And we have about 300 million alveoli in our lungs, right? And so there's air inside the alveolus, and there is the capillary that surrounds it on the outside. And so this is the structural unit where gas exchange takes place between air in an alveolus and the capillary, which is on the outside of it. So we call these respiratory bronchioles because they contain some alveoli. And this one is not a respiratory bronchiole because it doesn't have alveoli on it. So these kind of look like just a bunch of grapes hanging right there. But before I move away, right, so that's an alveolar sac, but before I move away from this illustration, do you see any lines? I don't know if the projector as well is good enough. Do you see any lines kind of crisscrossing over the surface of an alveolus? Anybody see something right there? Okay, those aren't the capillaries. These are elastic fibers, right? And that's going to be really important because when we're breathing normally, okay, it takes muscles to inhale, right? But when we want to exhale, all we have to do is relax those muscles, and guess what happens? That's right. All these elastic fibers that have been stretched when you inhale, when you relax those muscles, then they pull the alveolus back down to its normal shape, and that helps you exhale. So inhaling is an active process that requires muscle contraction. Exhalation is a passive process, and there only muscles have to relax, okay, because of these elastic tissues. All right, so I think I got a little bit of a demonstration right here. I've got a couple containers. Okay, I have a paper bag. What happened? I got a paper bag right here, and then I have a balloon. And I want you to think of the paper bag and a balloon as an alveolus, right? So some kind of chamber. And I want you to tell me which one is a better model of an alveolus, right? So what does an alveolus have on the inside? On the inside. Elastic on the outside. I like elastic on the outside. But what's on the inside? So what's it? What flows through this bronchiole? Oh, you can't see what I'm pointing at. What flows through this bronchiole into this terminal bronchiole, into this respiratory bronchiole, and then into an alveolus? Okay. What's inside these tubes right here is air, right? So air comes down through the trachea, air through the bronchus, into these bronchioles, and then into an alveolus. So there's air on the inside of an alveolus. The blood is going to be on the outside. All right, so pretend this is an alveolus. And what does an alveolus have on the inside? Air. So let's put some air in here, okay? So I got this bag last night on the way home. Good bag. Okay, so here's an alveolus. When you inhale, this alveolus is going to expand, right? Like so. All right, so we have air and alveolus, and then I'm going to let this alveolus relax. And what's going to happen to all the air inside of it? Okay. Yeah, it should leave, right? So I make sure that it's open, so there's a little passageway. And I'm going to let go, and I just let it go. Is it collapsing? Is the air leaving? It's not. Okay. Well, let's compare it with this alveolus right here. Okay, I tried a bunch of these balloons and they all broke. Let's see if this one works. As you can see, I got a bunch. Okay, let's try it. So here's the alveolus. What's on the inside? Air. Oh, good. Okay, so I got some air. Oops, sorry. I got some air in this alveolus. Okay, and now I'm just going to let go. What's going to happen to the air in this alveolus? Yeah, it just leaves, right? Because what kind of tissue is that balloon? It's elastic, right? So when you exhale, you don't need any muscle. Air just leaves the alveolus automatically. Right? Some people have a condition where that all those elastic fibers degenerate and they're left with paper bags. And when that happens, what can they not do? They can inhale normally, but they can't exhale. And if you can't exhale, then you can't get new air in there, right? So that's a huge problem when that happens. So one thing I should say is don't smoke anything, right? Because your lung tissue is really delicate and that damages elastic tissues, and it's terrible if you can't exhale. All right, so that's some elastic properties that I see right here. All right, well, that doesn't explain gas exchange, but the next figure does. Well, we're on our way to explaining it. Here is an alveolar sac. Here are all of the alveoli, and there are pores between the alveoli so that air can go from one alveolus to the other so it can be distributed evenly throughout the whole alveolar sac. And I can see the elastic elastic fibers really nice right here. Here's a nice picture of a normal lung, what a normal lung looks like. All right, well, this is a better illustration, right? So we were looking at this alveolar sac with the elastic fibers. Here is another one without elastic fibers, but now what do we see? Capillaries that surround each of these alveoli. So here is a vessel. And what kind of vessel is this? Give me the name of this vessel. What's the name of this vessel? It's sort of like a trick question, but it is not a trick question. Okay, is this systemic circulation or pulmonary circulation? Pulmonary circulation, yeah. And then, what are the two kinds of vessels that either bring blood from the heart or to the heart? Artery and vein. All right, so here's a pulmonary. Is it a pulmonary artery or pulmonary vein? Okay, I'm glad a lot of people said artery. Even though it's blue, are you sure? Positive. Excellent. So here is the pulmonary artery bringing relatively deoxygenated blood to an alveolus. Here's the capillary. What happens in that capillary? Exchange. So CO2 leaves this blue blood, oxygen enters, colors it red, and then this blood returns to the heart via this vessel, and this is the pulmonary vein. Right, so pulmonary veins are going to be colored red in all the models that we have because they're high in oxygen, because it's taking blood back to the heart from the lungs. Pulmonary arteries are going to be blue because they're delivering blood to the lungs to pick up oxygen. Right, so make sure that you can recognize this as a pulmonary circulation. So if you think of systemic circulation and pulmonary circulation, should you think of them as being the same thing? And I'm just going to kind of make a diagram with my fingers. I don't like to think of them like that. I like to think that they are opposite each other, right? Arteries and veins in the systemic circulation are opposite compared to arteries and veins in the pulmonary circulation, two separate circulations. All right, so here is an alveolus. Let's see what's on the next slide. Well, that looks good. So we zoomed way in to an alveolus, and here is an epithelium right through here. What kind of epithelium is that? I heard it. Simple squamous epithelium, right? So it's just a flat cell that's really thin. So it is not a barrier for exchange. Right, so things can move across it. If this is a big columnar cell or a stratified epithelium, then that would prevent exchange from taking place. Right, so the wall of the alveolus is a simple squamous epithelium, and guess what the wall of a capillary is? You can see it over here. That endothelium is a simple squamous epithelium as well. We call it an endothelium because it's on the inside of a blood vessel. Here we can see some nice red blood cells. So this structure right here, we call this the respiratory membrane. This is what oxygen and CO2 have to move across to get from one place to the other. And what makes this respiratory membrane are three things. It's the wall of the capillary. It's a little very thin interstitial space, some connective tissue, and then the wall of the alveolus. That's the respiratory membrane, right? Those three things. All right, so if we look inside this alveolus, oh, I see some macrophages right here. What's the job of this macrophage? Fight infection, that's right, because we breathe in all kinds of stuff, right, and can end up inside an alveolus right here. So this guy is crawling around all the time. Where did this macrophage come from? Came from the blood, right? It was a monocyte, and it can crawl out into this alveolus, right? And when it crawls out, it's no longer called a monocyte. It's called a macrophage. And it moves by diapedesis, kind of like an amoeba. It can just shift its size. It's a shapeshifter kind of cell, and it can kind of crawl around everywhere. And then when it bumps into a bacteria, right, it will grab it, and then this macrophage will then find its way to the thymus gland. It will crawl back into the blood, go to the thymus gland, and then will teach the cells of the thymus gland how to identify that bacteria and kill it in most cases, but not in all cases. This is sort of interesting. There's one kind of bacteria that knows how to defeat that process, and that is called anthrax. Right? And so when anthrax bacteria gets in the lung, macrophage gobbles it up, takes it to the thymus gland, and then that anthrax bacteria can attack and kill the thymus gland. One of a few kinds of bacteria that can actually do that. So respiratory infections due to anthrax that are breathed in is a very dangerous kind of disease because it directly attacks the immune system via that way. And these macrophages don't really know what they're doing. They're just doing their job like they should be doing. Okay, so the cells, the simple squamous epithelium that make up an alveolus is what we call a type 1 alveolar cell. It makes up the wall. Here is another kind of cell. This is a type 2. It secretes something called surfactant, right? And here's another type 2, here's another type 2, right? And it secretes surfactant onto the surface of, the inside surface of an alveolus, right? And so I got a couple of questions for you. Is water, which is inside our lungs, water is coating all of those alveoli, is water slippery or is it sticky? Slippery, yeah. If there's a puddle of water and you step on it, you might slip. But you know what? There are some animals that are so light, they can actually walk right on the surface of water. Have you ever seen like a water spider or something? Okay. And that's because water molecules like to stick together. They're chemical properties, right? And so I want to change your opinion and think that water is not slippery, it is actually sticky. It's like glue. And so how can we prove that? Here I have a couple transparencies. Hopefully I can get this demo to work. Sometimes it doesn't work. So I got two transparencies. I'm going to put them together like this, and then I'm going to hold on to one of them. What's going to happen to the other? If when I let go of the other one, it's just going to fall away, right? Okay. Well, I want to glue these together. Where can I go and get some glue? Right here. Got some in the water faucet, right? Hopefully there's water in there. All right, so there's my glue. Nice. Hopefully nobody had something in that sink right there. I see some stuff. Okay, here's that other transparency. We'll put them together, like so. And I'm just going to make sure that they're touching each other really nice, like that. Okay, so now I have the same transparencies, right, that fell apart when I let go of the first one. And I'm going to let go of one of them. And what happened to the one that I let go of? It stuck, right? So there's actually, but there's water actually acts like a glue. Now, I want to prove to you that that's actually a pretty strong force. So somebody grab that other transparency. I'm going to drip a little water. Okay, I'm going to hold on to this one. Grab the bottom one. Okay, that was pretty tough to pull it apart, wasn't it, at first? So water really is a glue that makes things stick together. And so how does that relate to this alveolus? Well, when we exhale, there's no air inside these alveoli, and one side of the alveolus can touch the other side. And there's water in there. They can glue themselves together. And when they glue themselves together, they don't inflate, so you can't inhale. So that's kind of a terrible situation that develops. But the type 2 cell secretes a compound called surfactant, and it disrupts that chemical property that we call surface tension. So what made those things hard to pull apart was surface tension. And surfactant is like a soap or a detergent, which is kind of slippery. It can interact with water, and it just breaks all of those bonds between the water molecules so that things can slip apart. So if an alveolus has surfactant in it, it can inflate very nicely. Without surfactant, it can't. And these type 2 cells are activated pretty much at end of term of a fetus, and they're really activated by stress, by a normal birthing process. They become activated and they secrete surfactant, so when an infant is born, their lungs can inflate pretty normally. But a premature baby, these type 2 cells are not mature, they can't produce surfactant, so a premature baby has difficulty what? Breathing. Yeah, air can't get into these alveoli. And in that particular case, you know, we just don't throw our hands up. What do we do to help that premature baby? Yeah. You can intubate them, maybe put them on a respirator, I don't know if I've ever seen that, but probably if they're in really severe respiratory distress, okay, and then you can give them some oxygen. But what is something simpler, maybe if somebody isn't so distressed? Okay, a premature baby can't regulate temperature very well. That's another hint. Incubator, that's right. So a closed container, you regulate the temperature and you adjust the oxygen concentration above normal concentration so that it's easier for oxygen to diffuse into their body. Right? So that is a way of compensating. Now, I think when we were talking about senses, that can be a problem. Why can that be a problem for a newborn? Breathing oxygen that's at high concentration like that. It's helping oxygen get in their body. Anybody kind of remember? Okay. Oxygen can diffuse through the cornea, right, through that posterior chamber and bump into the retina. And what kind of cells does the retina have? Rods and cones, not neurons, right, but photoreceptor cells. But if the retina receives a lot of oxygen, then blood vessels from the choroid will grow up into the retina and push away the photoreceptor cells. So if somebody's an incubator, guess what one of the possible dangerous side effects are? Blindness, right? They call that retinopathy when the retina isn't working of prematurity. So medicine is always a judgment of one good thing, but there's always side effects that you have to pay attention to. All right, so that is surfactant. That's important. And I think I'm going to stop right there. Sign-in sheet is going around. And we're just a little bit ahead of schedule, but not too far ahead of schedule. So that's good. We're just going to talk about mechanics of breathing and maybe control of respiration. And that's it. Next time, we're going to move on to the next chapter. What's the next chapter? What is the next chapter? Digestive system. Oh, digestive system is so disgusting and gross. You'll love it. It's the best lecture ever. Yes. Yeah.